This episode is sponsored by Macmillan Audio. I love reading historical novels that focus on women's experiences in unexplored time periods and settings. And The Divorcees, a stunning debut novel by Rowan Baird, read by Bailey Carr, does just that. You can listen in on what it was like at one of Reno's famous divorce ranches of the 1950s, where women came to spend a 6 weeks residency, the state's only divorce requirement at the time, riding horses by day and flirting with cowboys at night. This is a riveting page-turner that is the perfect choice for your next book club. Start listening to The Divorcees by Rowan Baird now, wherever audiobooks are sold. Hello and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm your host, librarian and writer, Laura Zaro-Kopinski. And today I'm so excited that Henriette Lazaridis is back to discuss her new novel, Last Days in Plaka. Think The Talented Mr. Ripley by way of Elena Ferrante. It explores the lies at the heart of an old woman's identity and the desperation of a young woman's struggle to belong. Henriette is the author of The Clover House, Terra Nova, and Last Days in Plaka. She earned degrees in English from Middlebury College, Oxford, where she was a Rhodes Scholar, and the University of Pennsylvania. Having taught English at Harvard, she now teaches at Grub Street in Boston. She was the founding editor of the Drum Literary Magazine, runs the Kruna Writing Workshop in Northern Greece, and her essays and articles have been published in Elle, the New York Times, and more, and earned her a Massachusetts Cultural Council Artist Grant. An avid athlete, she writes about athletic and creative challenges at the Entropy Hotel on Substack. Henriette, welcome back, and congratulations on Last Days in Plaka. I've really been looking forward to getting to chat again and hearing more about writing this new novel.
No, it's a treat, Laura. Thanks for having me back. It feels like it was not that long ago that we had the other conversation.
I know, and you've produced a whole other great book by then. I'm so fascinated. The setting is so interesting in this book, and the women in it are these really complex, interesting characters. And I'm just so curious to dive in and hear more. For listeners who have not gotten to take a peek at all yet, can you tell us a little bit more about the women at the center of this book and kind of where we find them at the start of the novel?
Yeah, they're sort of unlikely friends, very unlikely friends, who are introduced to each other by the priest, which right away, this is in Athens, and that's kind of surprising because most Greeks don't attend church regularly. They'll go for special events and holidays. But so I don't know, I was interested in a person who would be a regular church attendant. And that's the old woman, Irini, in the story. But then she's sort of the priest fobs onto her, a young Greek-American woman named Anna, who is a little lost and has turned to the church as her perhaps misguided solution to the problem of wanting to connect to her parents' culture. And so they form this unlikely friendship, but things start to be not quite as they seem. And poor Anna is a little bit in for some lessons in life. Is that the right way to say it? I don't want to sound too cryptic, but...
Without giving too much away, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I have never been to Greece. It's on my bucket list, but I really feel like I got to travel there and experience Athens and get a feel for the culture, I guess a little bit like Anna. And, you know, I know that you travel there for your writing workshop. Well, not Athens specifically, but I'm just wondering, having spent a lot of time in Greece, were you able to really kind of draw on that for capturing the setting? Like, were you already ready to really bring this world to life? Or did you have to do like extra research trips? Because it just, I felt so transported. I'm kind of wondering how you accomplished that.
No, thank you. I mean, I wrote the novel during the pandemic, during a time when travel to Greece was actually impossible. And that was, I think, one of the reasons that it sort of arrived into my head uninvited and unexpected while I was working on another project that I was actually a little bit bored by. And then one day here were these women and I was like, wait a second, they're calling for my attention. Who are these people? And I think yes, I've spent a lot of time in Athens because growing up, well, my whole life, we went to Greece for 3 months a year when I was, you know, on summer break from school, and would always stay with my grandmother in not the very heart of Athens, but part of Athens. And so I missed it. And I think that's what led me to come up with this story. And I didn't have to do really any additional research except for things like how to get from one place to another. I was thinking there's a moment in the book when Irini, the old woman, walks what is for her a considerable distance. And I had to sort of look at the map and think, hold on, could you do that? And where would you go? And what would you see? And I needed the map for some assistance there because, you know, just to make sure it was accurate.
Well, the other thing that I thought was really interesting as you're sort of experiencing the world of Athens, it made me realize the shortfalls I have when it comes to particularly modern Greek history. And that's kind of an important foundation for the book. And, you know, World War II in particular, I feel like I read a lot about or read a lot of historical fiction and really have not read much at all about the experiences of sort of everyday people in Greece during that time. And I'm curious, did you already have a really solid foundation in that? And because that World War II experience is sort of present for Irini kind of in the story, could you talk a little bit about what that experience was like for people in Athens in that time period?
Yeah, so Irini would be right around the age that my parents were. And my father lived through the German occupation of Athens. My mother grew up in a different city where they were occupied by the Italians. And I drew on that when I was writing the historical portions of The Clover House, which takes place in Greece, both contemporary and World War II era Greece. But so I knew, my father would tell stories about walking the streets of Athens during the horrible famine of 1941 and seeing people just drop down dead on the street. So some of what Irini is alluding to when she's talking to Anna about her experiences in wartime, which she's cryptic about, but still she does talk a little bit about them. All of that is stuff that my father's generation knew very well. I think there's a reference to in the novel, Irini tells a story about or remembers having seen someone writing anti-German graffiti on a wall and then hit by the butt of a rifle. My father saw that. And I have a picture. My father was a really avid photographer. Even during the war, he would stick a camera in his coat and go around and take pictures of like German tanks and things.
Oh, wow.
And, in his photos, I have it. It's a photograph of a boy in the middle of writing, Hitler is a...
Oh my gosh, wow.
And so I drew on things like that when I was writing her story. But the people in Athens, people who were of that generation, who lived through the occupation, they were under a terrible famine, whether you were well-to-do or not. It was just really hard to get calories. And this was, I could go on at length, but...
Well, I really hadn't even known about the famine, so it was just really compelling and just the, you know... sort of the ripple effects of that on people, you know, forever after. I mean, that's something that's such a trauma to experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you do see, or not so much anymore, but you used to see in that older generation, you'd see people who were very short. And it was clear, especially if they were of a certain, like Greece is a very class-bound society. And if you saw someone who was of a working class person who was very, very short and of a certain age, you could pretty much guess that person had suffered malnutrition in childhood during the famine in the Second World War. So Irini's character was a little more fortunate than that because she is a well-to-do person and now formerly well-to-do. But yes, the effects of that on someone. And then as a sort of seminal event for the story is this earthquake that happened 18 years before the action of the novel. There was a very big damaging earthquake in Athens that had an important effect on people who were not able to repair their homes because people don't have insurance in Greece. They don't believe in it. That was another big cataclysmic effect in Greek culture that sort of echoes through the story of Last Days in Plaka.
Yeah, it's such a rich setting and, yeah, just such an interesting culture to be transported to. It really makes me want to travel there. And the other thing I thought was interesting, kind of when I had my writer hat on, I thought the way you approached letting us know that in the real world of the book, the characters would be speaking Greek, but, you know, obviously you're writing it in English, but there were, I can't think of the exact examples now, but there's some touches where you kind of make it clear that that's the case. And there's like sprinkling of Greek words and things in there. But did it take you a little time to figure out how you wanted to approach that? Because I know for me, it gave me some helpful aha moments for characters that need to be speaking Polish in my work in progress. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I could kind of like just allude to that here and there.
I'm very much of the belief that for me anyway, because people do things differently among different books, but I prefer to render people's foreign speech, like non-English speech, in the same style that it would be in their actual language, but just render it that way in English. So if it's a swear, I'm not going to translate the exact same swear, which usually doesn't make sense, right? Swears in a foreign language, when you translate them literally, they're sort of weird. So I wouldn't do that. I would just use the equivalent profanity that we would use in that particular situation. And how weird that I'm choosing profanity as an example. But I sort of
it's a good
like
example,
you just,
though.
You render the people's speech. Like if someone is speaking in slang, you do slang, but in English. If someone is speaking really formally, you do formally, but in English. And yeah, there are moments where Anna uses maybe a wrong word and someone calls her on it. And I have to explain to the reader, hopefully not in a very pedantic way, that she has used the wrong word. And then I think I do quote the Greek word or something to sort of show, she did this wrong.
It's bringing it back to me. There was one example of when they're talking about like the apocalypse and there's not, I think there's like not more than one word in Greek or something, but there was something like that. Yeah. We're like, oh yeah, they're talking and she's trying to, you know, use her Greek skills to the best of her ability, but sometimes she's still falling short and we get like a window into that here and there.
Right. And that word in particular, because it is a book called Last Days in Plaka, people are thinking about the end of days. The little congregation is studying the book of Revelation. So apocalypse in its religious and sort of secular connotation, those are important. And it just so happens that the word in Greek, apokalypse, is the apocalypse, but it also just means a revelation, like not revelation, but any revelation or discovery or unveiling, you know, so that was something that I wanted to play with because of course the character, both of them, they experience various revelations of a secular kind while they're purportedly studying the book of Revelations.
Yeah. I just thought that was really interesting to get to see that, how you handled that, and it was just very well done and enough to make us feel like we're, you know, still very much in that country and in that world, but of course accessible to the English reader. So yeah. I thought that was really well done.
Because I think I'm glad that you felt that. I think that there's a danger when you start to do things like throw in the foreign word in the middle of a sentence. It's sort of othering of the characters, and they're not other, they're living their lives. So
right.
Why not present them as just living their lives and speaking to each other in the fluency that they possess in their actual language? So that's why I do it that way.
One thing I noticed too, as I was reading the acknowledgments in the book, you had a lot of different writing groups that you mentioned or different writers that have sort of helped you. And I'm curious sort of what your writing community looks like at this stage of your career, what sharing your work looks like at this point, and yeah, just kind of the role of other writers and writing groups in your kind of current writing life.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's true. I think I mentioned three different groups because I do have three.
I love that.
Not all at once, though. But
yeah,
I'm someone, everybody's different. I'm someone who I'm not ever really hesitant to share work. It's, for me, that's part of the joys is just the sharing, and the sooner I can share it, the better. And I don't mind, of course, if you're sharing something rough and then you say, okay, look, this is really rough. Let's hear what you guys think about it. And so when I wrote Last Days in Plaka, it was the pandemic, and my writing group, The Pandemics, a name that was giftedly coined by Kathy Elsick. We met on Zoom, and we met every week, if I remember correctly. And that was very much a, like, you're just sharing really rough stuff as it comes out. And that was really helpful just to keep me going. And so I've enjoyed that approach, which is very intense. But I've also enjoyed the more, every month kind of approach, which I have with my other, the Salties, the Salt and Radish writing group.
They all have great names.
Spread out. Yes, they do. They do. And I can take zero credit for any of them. And then I use the other group of another cohort of friends who it all started when they were taking a class with me that ended right at the start of the pandemic when we all went on Zoom, and I said, look, this isn't the time for us to go our separate ways. If you want to keep meeting, let's keep meeting. And so we've been meeting every Thursday since then. And
wow.
That's more, and I like that for sharing, but just like checking in, like, here's a little one page thing. Let's see how it's going. And so I feel like every group, for me, it suits me because every group kind of is, training a different muscle. Like, there's the fast twitch and the slow twitch and the even slower twitch, and they all kind of work. So my writing community is lots and lots of people, I feel like, I love that. And there's sort of tighter connections with certain individuals or certain smaller groups within that. And to me, I mean, that suits me. But it's not everybody's cup of tea, I realize.
Yeah, no, that's, I think it's helpful to hear how different writers do it, and having different groups sort of maybe feed different parts of your creative life or help you in different ways. It's definitely one way.
I think that's one for everyone to realize that, like, it's not a one size fits all kind of thing. Like, everybody has to figure out what works for you the best. And if not sharing until you're really, really done is your jam, then that's great. And if sharing all the time, which is kind of my approach, if that suits you, that's great too. And also, things change. You don't have to be one way forever, right? Each project kind of proceeds along a completely different path of its own and might require different kinds of community and different kinds of sharing. So it's important, I think, to listen to that. It's hard enough doing it, writing a book. We can risk making it harder for ourselves.
That's so true. And even I like what you're saying about even within a project, it can change at different times. I feel like right now I'm in a, like, not really sharing a ton phase as I just try to, really lean into it. And at different times, what's kept me going is sharing a ton. So it just kind of being open to change, I think, is good advice. One of the times where I was sharing my work in progress was in a really fantastic revision course that you were teaching through Grub Street that I was able to be a part of. And so I'm curious, because I feel like I got so many helpful tips on revision from you during that course. Are there any particular strategies that you used for revising Last Days in Plaka that you would want to share, or anything that you just felt like was really helpful during that stage of writing?
That's a good question. I think for that one, I had to sit down and sort of map it after I wrote it and see things like, because I was writing an omniscient point of view, I wanted to make sure that the handoffs between one character's experience and another's didn't feel like head hopping, and that we weren't losing sight of a particular character for too long. And so I sort of wrote it all. I mean, that was the thing. I don't even think I broke it down into chapters as I was writing it. I think if I were to look at the manuscript now, which is handwritten because I was writing longhand, I would just see like page after page after page after page. And so that required a lot of like looking at it afterwards and saying, okay, hold on, let's break this down into units and figure out how those units are going to fit together. So it was sort of like stepping back and trying to see the bones in the story and forget about the verbiage for a minute and identify what was happening and who was the focus, and then see how I needed to put things together, if I needed to tweak things and move them around, which I did a little bit, not a huge amount, but because I was mindful of it as I was going along. I was like, if you're doing omniscient, you have to pay attention. You can't be bouncing around all the time. So a little bit of that stepping back and looking at the essential elements.
Yeah, I think that stepping back and kind of mapping things after you've written something is one of the helpful takeaways that I had gotten from you during that class. I'm remembering just like putting post-its all over my wall. And yeah. I had to do that again recently. And I do feel like, you know, before each revision now, as I kind of keep tweaking things, I have to go back and be like, what do I really have here? And like, how can I, I need to be able to see it. And I really am not, I'm not someone who can really plan a lot before, but then after I've kind of been writing, then I can kind of map things out and plan a little bit better. So I just think that's helpful.
That makes sense to me. And I think that's the thing, is that sometimes you don't want to get in your own way with too much planning. And like the novel I was writing that I got bored with when Last Days in Plaka came into my head, I think I had planned it to within an inch of its life, and it no longer held enough mystery for me, so I was kind of bored with it. So you don't want to get in your own way with too much planning, but then that's why I do think, yeah, when you're done or at a certain, maybe an intermediary point, because you reach a point and you think, okay, I've come this far, now what? And you have to sort of break trail for yourself before you can keep going. But oftentimes you can't even know that until you've written a significant chunk of pages. And then you can step back and kind of do the outline of what do I have here, and then see where you can go.
Yeah. And one thing that's kind of been helping me as I've been trying to do that before I dive in again is going back to some different helpful craft books. Some of these you've probably recommended to me. I went back to Story Genius, and there was one on structuring your novel. And so that makes me wonder, are there any particular craft books that you kind of keep going back to, or any that you've read lately that you've been recommending to maybe people taking your classes, or just any you would recommend to listeners?
Yeah, the ones that come to mind right away, and sort of two newer ones, relatively newer ones, are Matt Bell's Refuse to be Done, which is a great.
Yes, I just went back to that one too. It's so good.
Yeah, that one's really great. And also Matthew, everybody has to be named Matthew apparently. Matthew Salas's Craft in the Real World.
I haven't read that one yet.
Interesting as well. Yeah, and it does have a whole bunch of exercises at the back which pertain to revision, but then there's a lot of really interesting advice about character and everything, really, all elements of craft. So those two, and I would add those two to my sort of standard one, Story Genius, which you already mentioned, by Lisa Cron, and Ben Percy's Thrill Me, which is just great. And I love it. Percy draws on all forms of narrative, and there's no, I mean, I don't even, it doesn't even make sense to say high culture, low culture, because there isn't such a thing. There's only one level of culture. It's all culture. There's no, you know, and so, but he draws from all genres, and what we call literary fiction and thriller and horror and movies and television, and uses all of it to really explain how story should work and how suspense must work. It's really, really great. And it's just so entertainingly written as well.
Oh, I will link to all of those, and I'm definitely going to have to pick up Craft in the Real World and Thrill Me and add those to my list. And that's also making me wonder, beyond craft books, are there any other books in general that you've really enjoyed lately that you would want to recommend to listeners?
Oh, well, this is not going to be anything anyone's ever heard of before, but I'm reading most of the way through Demon Copperhead. Wait, did I say? Yes, Demon Copperhead right now by Barbara Kingsolver. And of course, I hesitated because part in my mind, I'm thinking David Copperfield, which is the obvious and explicit parallel. But anyway, I think that that novel is fantastic. And again, it's won the Pulitzer. It doesn't need me to say that it's fantastic. But especially as someone who studied Dickens in grad school, I find it just so fantastic. From narrative voice to storyline to just the importance as an American novel today, I think is fantastic.
Well, it's funny that you say that this morning because I was just interviewing Sheila Sundar, who wrote Habitations, and she was saying that Barbara Kingsolver is like the author for her that has really like shaped her as a writer. And she goes back to her books a lot. And I really have not read a lot of Barbara Kingsolver. So it's on my list. Well, are you able to say anything about what you're working on next or is it too early?
Oh, see, I'm the person who, no, it's never too early. I'll talk about it. I'm rewriting that novel that had once bored me and thankfully stopped boring me. And it's a novel that has to do with a cold case disappearance and a young, a 26-year-old woman physicist in 1972 whose mother is the disappeared. And so it has to do with a sort of that kind of mystery and the Manhattan Project and physics and the second law of thermodynamics.
Ooh, very interesting. Yeah. Well, and it's making me wonder too, because I feel like your books are coming out very quickly in succession. Are you kind of at a point where you are sort of saying like, okay, I need to have this draft done by then and I want my next book to come out by this time? Or is it just so happened that they're coming out very quickly right now?
Oh yeah, heavens no. No, this is like, because Terra Nova, I started writing Terra Nova in 2015, right? So it came out, I mean, again, that's not too slow, but it's just things are in inventory and they sit for a while and then some things, you write them and they don't go anywhere. And it's just, you know, it's dumb luck.
I like so, that though. Sometimes they're in inventory for a while. That's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. So the publication date, I think, doesn't always reflect the sequence in which things are written and produced, but.
That makes sense. Well, I really hope that listeners go pick up Last Days in Plaka. And I think especially if you're like me and have a real travel desire these days, but it needs to be more armchair travel. Mm-hmm. I think this would be good for that because you really do feel just immersed in Athens and kind of really get to experience that culture. And if anyone, I don't know if you have any classes that you are teaching soon, but just if people keep an eye on Grub Street, wherever you live, because oftentimes there's virtual classes. I highly recommend anything that Henriette teaches. I've gotten so much out of your classes. So,
there's still a couple spots in my workshop in Northern Greece for this summer. So,
and that too,
people can look into.
Awesome. Yeah, that's on my bucket list as well. Well, thank you so much for coming back on, Henriette, and congratulations again on the book and best of luck with all the promotion and your current writing.
Thank you, Laura. This was fantastic. Thanks for having me back.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can visit abookishhome.com. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you take a minute to subscribe and also rate and review wherever you get your podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to share it on social media to help other people find the show and this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and happy reading.